Today we're reading from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the Majjhalila, 2:7, verse 1-8.
Okay. Instruct everyone to follow the orders of Lord Sri Krishna as they are given in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. In this way, become a spiritual master and try to liberate everyone in this land. Purport by Srila Prabhupada, of course. This is the sublime mission of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Many people come and inquire whether they have to give up family life to join the society, but that is not our mission. One can remain comfortably in his residence. We simply request everyone to chant the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. If one is a little literate and can read the Bhagavad Gita as it is and Srimad Bhagavatam, that is so much the better. These works are now available in an English translation and are done very authoritatively to appeal to all classes of men. Instead of living engrossed in material activities, people throughout the world should take advantage of this movement and chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra at home with their families. One should also refrain from sinful activities, illicit sex, meat-eating, gambling, and intoxication. Out of these four items, illicit sex is very sinful. Every person must get married. Every woman especially must get married. If the women outnumber the men, some men may accept more than one wife. In that way, there will be no prostitution in society. If men can marry more than one wife, illicit sex will be stopped. One can also produce many nice preparations to offer Krishna, grain, fruit, flowers, and milk. Why should one indulge in unnecessary meat-eating and maintaining horrible slaughterhouses? What is the use of smoking and drinking tea and coffee? People are already intoxicated by material enjoyment, and if they indulge in further intoxication, what chance is there for self-realization? Similarly, one should not partake in gambling and unnecessarily agitate the mind. The real purpose of human life is to attain the spiritual platform and return to Godhead. That is the summum bonum of spiritual realization, that this Krishna consciousness movement is trying to elevate human society to the perfection of life by assuming the method described by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his advice to the Brahman Kumar. That is, one should stay at home, chant the Hare Krishna mantra, and preach the instructions of Krishna as they are given in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. I'll just read the English again, this verse. Instruct everyone to follow the orders of Lord Krishna as they are given in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. In this way, become a spiritual master and try to liberate everyone in this land. Om Agyanam Tridam Dasha Janangara Shalakaya Taksha Om Minitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Garabhaya Dadati Svapadam Tikam He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopikanta Radha Kanta Namostate Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vasaya Bhutale Shmati Bhaktivedanta Swamini Chinamine Namaste Sasvati Devi Gurvani Vicharine Nivasesha Shunyavadi Pashachade Satadine Jai Shri Krishna Tetanya Prabho Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Sivasati Guru Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So obviously, just brief, I think this was mentioned in yesterday's class by Nitai Kirtan Prabhu, but just to kind of, just so we know the context, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is on his extensive South Indian tour here, on a very important part of his preaching mission, altogether walking thousands of miles over a few years. And he meets, of course, this Brahmin, who is serving him very nicely in his own home, is obviously a very elevated Brahmin, actually, because he recognized Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's divinity. Feeding him and his wife, assumingly, feeding him very nicely in his house. But at the end, he said, "Can I come with you? I want to give up this householder life and just come with you." And what was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's reaction? Well, no, you do not. I'm not asking anyone to leave their wife and family. You should stay at home and practice from there. So this is a very important instruction, a very responsible instruction, actually, I believe, by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He was he was a sannyasi himself. In fact, he took sannyas very early on, when he was 24 years old. But he wasn't expecting, I suppose, everyone to do that. He was, after all, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But this this Brahmin that we speak of, we can assume it describes him as a householder, and we therefore assume he was already married, possibly with children as well, although I don't think that it's mentioned there. But Mahaprabhu basically just said, no, you just stay at home and you chant Hare Krishna, you preach from your own home, that is fine. That is, in fact, the Prabhupada's mission, Prabhupada's purport, says that is not our mission to artificially renounce. It says the sublime mission of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness is that we simply request everyone to chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra and then basically practice from home and do what you can. I mean, of course, that is for the vast majority of the population. Obviously, there may be a minority of men, a very small minority of men, that may never get married. But Prabhupada makes quite clear in his purport here that whenever possible, all women should get married because they need the protection, basically. The life of a sannyasi, especially from the perspective, I think, of Indian, traditional Indian culture, was to wander from one place to the other. And if there's no place to stay one evening, you would even have to sleep under a tree or something, whatever the Lord provided. So this is not a recommended lifestyle for any woman, actually. But there may be a very, very small percentage of men, 0.0-something%, that can do that. But even then, it is highly recommended that most of the time that sannyasis actually have followed the previous four ashrams as well, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprast, and then finally sannyas in the final stages of their life. And even then, only when they are qualified and their wives and their children have all grown up, etc. So this is important purport in that context from a sociological point of view. So the Prabhupada makes it very clear, actually, he's not interested in people artificially renouncing. Because one, it's not sustainable. Two, it sets the wrong example. And three, it can be divisive because the one of the worst, Prabhupada mentions in his purport, one of the worst things that can happen in society is that women are not protected, and as cows are not protected either, and seniors and children are also not protected. In such a society, is not a Vedic society. That's a demoniac society, actually. So there's no advantage in artificial renunciation. The different ashrams, in one sense, are different processes of, for most people, of purification. So that by the time one is perhaps in a position where a man can take sannyas, that he's already perhaps been purified, is already understood, and he's already ready to renounce as well. But a few other important points that Prabhupada mentions in his purport, he brings attention to the regulatory principles, the famous four regulatory principles that all initiated devotees are required to follow, and they make that promise in front of their Diksha Guru and sometimes Shiksha as well. The reason, I believe, one of the reasons why Prabhupada actually brings attention to the four regulatory principles is because he's basically saying, whether you're sannyas or a grihastha, you've still got to follow these principles. And if you do that, then spiritually you're fine. You know, that's what we required. But he is also making a distinction between grihastha and grihamedi. So grihasthas are basically devotee householders. Grihamedis are those who are non-devotee householders or those who are not following. So one of the challenges of householder life, I suppose, when compared with any type of ashram life, is that you're on your own, in a sense. You know, there's no one who's going to be following you home, watching what you do, and so on and so forth. So in one sense, there's a lot more responsibility involved, a lot more independence involved. And so Prabhupada here is saying, well, preach from your home, follow the regulatory principles, chant Hare Krishna. And that is, in a sense, is as good as sannyas, in a sense. From that, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took, obviously he's the Supreme Lord anyway, but one of the reasons why he took sannyas is for preaching purposes. Obviously there was a lot of Maivadi sannyasis around at the time in India and in Bengal who were getting a lot of respect, as are all sannyasis should. But of course, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's doctrine was different, Achintya Bheda Tattva, Bhakti Yoga, which cannot be experienced or truly realized from the impersonal perspective. However, such respect was still in India given to sannyasis, those in saffron basically, that as a preaching move, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas. And of course, here we are now, we're reading about him during his South Indian tour. So of course, some of the regulatory principles, I imagine that most people listening online and here today are more than familiar with these principles, but I think it's important to go over perhaps some of the more subtle aspects of them. For example, obviously, meat eating. Obviously, we all know about that one, I think. But often devotees who are doing book distribution or other type of preaching programs, sometimes people ask, well, what's wrong then? You know, it's always good to have a few extra tools. For example, someone said to me that the pain and the fear that an animal feels in the slaughterhouse is transferred into the meat that is later eaten from that animal's body, because slaughterhouses, animals are not stupid. You know, animals have intuition more so than they're given credit for. They know that they're going to die in that slaughterhouse. Now, you imagine the sense of pain and fear in that cow or in that sheep or in that pig and what they have to go through in that terrible, these terrible, terrible slaughterhouses. And that in their subtle body, that pain, that fear, that absolute horror remains in the meat that is there later distributed in restaurants and or finds itself on the plates of millions and, in fact, billions of people around the world. How can there be, when there are so many other healthier alternatives, how can there be any justification for eating corpses, frankly? Of course, nowadays there are even devotees who take a step further, they become vegans. But I think that's probably a subject for another time. I think that's a seminar in its own right. But of course, you know, the idea of that, the issue of cow's milk and organic milk and things like that. But at the very least, devotees should be having organic milk, and if they can get ahimsa milk, that is, of course, ideal. But let's see what else there is here. Gambling. Of course, we all know about the principle of no gambling. Of course, gambling, there are more subtle aspects to that. It's not just a case of going to the casino in Las Vegas and going on the slot machines or whatever, although that is a form of gambling. Of course, but other subtle forms of gambling as well we have to consider. For example, whatever would bring the similar anxieties, winners and losers, support, you know, being devout to a football team, for example, where they're bringing out that passion and that material attachment, in a sense is also a form of gambling. Or the horse racing is obviously a form of gambling, and it takes subtle and gross forms, but all it does, it is motivated by greed. It is motivated by identifying oneself very closely to something else that is material. And it is like a roulette, really, almost like a Russian roulette on your own consciousness. Will you win? Will you lose? It can be addictive. I've heard this story about someone who dabbled in gambling, a non-devotee who dabbled in gambling, and in the very beginning they did very, very well. And because of their so-called success in the beginning, the rest of their life, they were simply trying to make their money back, because then they started to lose it later. And after 30 years of gambling, they ended off worse than they were when they started, even though they had a big win in the beginning, because it was, you know, it is addictive. So, of course, that's not good. Intoxication, also addictive. Prabhupada, actually, here, we also know, of course, about the, you know, how drugs, or even cigarette smoking, is not just bad for the health, but bad for the mind, and also can cover the soul. And Prabhupada even adds, what is the use of drinking tea and coffee? So Prabhupada here is putting his foot down here. Of course, I think here I imagine that Prabhupada is referring to caffeine as opposed to non-caffeinated thing, because obviously things like barley cup, which they sell in the shop, or decaffeinated items are probably not a problem. And there's a brahmacharya we used to call barley cup, kami cup. do you remember that? Yeah. But of course, it's okay, it's fine. Chicory as well is a nice drink. But basically here, that the caffeine has, again, is not only addictive, it is a subtle form of drug, actually. Let's see what I've written about caffeine. Too much can increase worry, racing, can make the heart race, it can reduce sleep, can prevent relaxation, and is, of course, detrimental for meditation and yoga and so forth. Anyway, the final, of course, reg, of course, is illicit sex, which Prabhupada refers to a lot, actually, in his purport. In fact, he says that's very, very sinful. In fact, what I decided to do, that's often, is usually, traditionally, a kind of a sensitive subject, anything to do with that. But in the Veda base, I Googled it, and there's 1,600 hits just for that. So it's mentioned quite a lot. And nearly all the time, I think 98% of the time, Prabhupada defines illicit sex basically as, well, there's two levels. That there's no sex outside of the sacred bond of marriage, of course. And he also sometimes refers to it as, even within a devotee community, it should be reduced and managed, mainly, of course, for the propagation of children. This is important, but I wanted to read a little bit more about that, or something which touches on that, in the context of ashram, and the fact that what we're dealing with here, the ashrams facilitate a gradual purification to the point when one is older, one is able to give up subtle and gross sex life altogether, referring, obviously, aspiring for it, wishing for it, and so on and so forth. So let's see what Prabhupada said in his lecture in Boston in 1968 on the Srimad Bhagavatam. He said, "The order of Vedic life, first of all brahmachari, our student life, then householder life. After student life is finished, with the permission of his spiritual master, he goes home, he marries a nice girl and becomes a pacified householder, a gentleman. And when he has a grown-up child, he prepares himself for sannyas, and that stage is called vanaprastha." So, of course, here this is very important. Vanaprastha means that one should leave home, but the wife can go with him as an assistant without any sex life. So, vanaprastha is a renounced and honourable ashram where one is still with one's wife, but is basically focused on 100% focused on spiritual life. Prabhupada continues that when the man is completely prepared, he sends his wife back home to be taken care of by the grown-up children, and then he can take sannyas. So this sannyas life means he has to completely give up sex life. Continue. I'll just read a bit more here, it's quite interesting. So to become a great soul is to completely forget sex life, because if one has a connection with it, he cannot be a mahat, or a great soul. One who is addicted to it, he will continue in his material existence. He may be born in a human society, an animal society, or born in a demigod society. So long as one has the propensity of sex life, he will have different kinds of body in this material world. So because in this material world, the ultimate happiness is sex life, either in dogs or a hog or a man, the ultimate material pleasure is that. So one has to train himself to know how to get out of this sex desire. So frankly, it's a tall order, is it not? Because the reproductional instinct, let's say, is not what Prabhupada here referring to the demigods. It is prevalent throughout the universe. In fact, Lord Brahma made it that way. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a population. We'd all be like the four Kumaras, or some of the advanced yogis who were created by Lord Brahma at the beginning of the universe, who did not want to go for the hassle, frankly. They looked, and they had seen, many of them had understood what the real world was like, the spiritual world. And in comparison, the material world, especially at the beginning of the universe, was dark, was ugly, was unattractive. So why reproduce in this place? So Lord Brahma had to give an impetus. He had to make such desires very, very strong. And so in all species of life, not just, of course, humans, that goes without saying, or demigods, but also animals, well, especially animals, actually. But it's strong. It's a strong urge, and it's a natural urge, actually. Therefore, should be treated in the human form of life as something sacred that should be done within marriage, as opposed to an animal, which, of course, would be just to act on one's instinct. That, of course, is the difference between human and animal. In fact, one of the main differences is the idea of, I have these senses, I have these desires, I have these needs, but I'm not just going to pursue them without restriction. I'm going to live within human society, within have a cultured human existence. And every time we talk about or think about a cultured civilization or human existence, it is always coupled with the idea of some degree of sense control. Thus, we built civilization based on that to a large degree, some sense of control. Is it easy? No. Can it be done? Yes, I'm told. By following, of course, the regulatory principles, by continuing to chant Hare Krishna no matter what happens throughout one's life. It's a very interesting thing I felt, anyway, that Prabhupada also mentions in his purport. I think it's quite fascinating, actually. Let me just read it to you. Bear with me a second. I've got the wrong page here. Where is it? I'll find it. Oh, yes. If the women outnumber the men, some men may accept more than one wife. Okay, so that's interesting. That's obviously a reference to polygamy and Prabhupada's approval of it, really. Not necessarily as kind of an ideal, but obviously it's something which he basically says is preferable to unprotected women or an increase of prostitution. Because the reality is that what we understand is that in a society where women are not protected by husbands, men, family and so forth, they can be very easily exploited by unscrupulous men. Not all men, but there's always going to be enough unscrupulous men in society who are going to exploit women, and therefore they need to be protected. It doesn't mean that they don't have a sense of course, their own spiritual life and so forth, but for practical purposes, they should be honoured and protected by gentlemen, really. However, let's see what Prabhupada is talking here about polygamy. Because I imagine in some circles that might be considered a little bit controversial. But let's delve in, shall we? I'm going to paraphrase here Prabhupada's purport on the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adilila 1458. In India, in those days, and even until 50 years ago, polygamy was freely allowed. Any man, Brahmana, Vaishya, particularly the Kshatriyas, could marry more than one wife. In the Mahabharata, we see the Kshatriya kings especially used to marry many wives. According to the Vedic civilization, there is no restriction against this. But to be married to a man who has many wives was not a very pleasing situation, because the husband's love will be divided amongst his many wives. To punish the girls unwilling to offer him anything, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu apparently wanted to curse them to be married to men who had at least four wives. Because the actual verse for this purport reads, if you are miserly and do not give me the offerings, every one of you will have an old husband with at least four wives. Okay, so it was not a compliment, but at least it was acknowledged in society at the time. Shishirar Goklanan ki jai Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai Shishigonitai ki jai Shopapad ki jai. Shopapad continues. He says, the social structure allowing a man to marry more than one wife can be supported in the following way. Generally, in every society, the female population is greater in number than the male population. Therefore, if it is a principle in society that all girls should be married, unless polygamy is allowed, it will not be possible. If all the girls are not married, there's a good chance of adultery, and a society in which adultery is allowed cannot be very peaceful or pure. In our Krishna-conscious society, we have restricted illicit sex. The practical difficulty is to find a husband for each and every girl. We are therefore in favour of polygamy, provided, of course, that the husband is able to maintain more than one wife. It's quite interesting, actually, here Prabhupada is very open, it would seem, to this principle. But there's a bit of a kind of a warning at the end where it says, provided they're able to do so. In other words, I think that in this country, in this day and age, 5,000 years into Kali Yuga, and I think that it's very impractical, practically, if not legal in this country for a start. Plus, if someone's living in a studio flat in North London somewhere, I think more than one wife is probably more than enough. Of course, Prabhupada here is saying this is particularly the Kshatriyas, referring to the Mahabharat. In the Mahabharat, thousands of years ago, of course, Kshatriyas, kings, princes, that of the Kshatriya order, were taking more than one wife, but they also would have a very big place. They often have palaces. They were wealthy Kshatriyas. And also, they were not just wealthy, they were powerful, they were a lot stronger, actually. And also, they were heroic, and so forth. So, often would even take women, an extra wife, for her benefit, actually, if not for his own. So, they were chivalrous as well. So, one of the questions, I think, on this subject, then, is how many Kshatriyas are there actually today, when compared with the kind of Kshatriyas that were around in the Mahabharat? And the answer is there were none, actually. Compared to the standards, let's say, of Brahmanas and of Kshatriyas of Vedic times, as in before the Kali Yuga, we are all of the lowest class, actually, in relative terms. So therefore, again, we cannot artificially follow something which was followed perhaps by Maharaj and the various Maharajas, as we read about, or even in the Ramayana, like Dashrath had a few wives, for example. Do we have their wealth? No. So what we can do. However, my understanding or unpacking, if you like, Prabhupada's purport here, analysing it, it would appear that there has to be some type of system in ISKCON, where all women are protected, so that we don't have, a situation where, like that, where the women, female population in particular, are unprotected. That would be a worst case scenario for the society. So whatever checks and balances in place, perhaps should be there. So that's quite interesting, and some would consider quite controversial standards, because of course it's not practiced, at least not in the West. In this day and age, nor would it be recommended for the vast majority of the population. So often what we find in Prabhupada's purports, I think, are ideals. We have an ideal. Prabhupada here is telling us, as it was in the times, or before the Mahabharat, in the times of Ram or whatever, which of course is going way further back, or in the times of Krishna, in the times of Yudhisthira, saying, look, this is how human society should be, this is how it was. Now we're here in a 21st century, Kali Yuga and all the rest of it. So what do we do? And of course, all we really have of any great potency are the holy names. And this is the great thing, of course, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu left behind, and Prabhupada's books, obviously, and so forth, and the instructions of Srila Prabhupada. So these are our tools, these are our things, and these should be our, our template for our lives. And we have to be practical, of course, but also we have to be realistic with ourselves, because we were talking earlier about the dangers or the problems, sociological problems, actually, of artificial renunciation. Not only would that externally be a problem, internally it could be an issue as well, because artificial renunciation is ultimately a manifestation of one's false ego. I'm great, I'm above all these things, And, of course, 99.99% of the time we're not. So therefore, it takes a bit of humility and a realistic look, I think, at ourselves when it comes to our personal needs and desires of, as human beings, really. Obviously, human beings are superior to that of animals, but nevertheless, we are who we are, and we have our conditioning, we have our limitations, we have our needs, and therefore, of course, Prabhupada here is saying, you know, practically everybody should get married and follow the Varna Ashram system. And as I mentioned earlier, there may indeed be a few great souls, Mahatmas or whatever, that don't need to go for that system. But they are few and far between. And if you're running a society or you're giving presentations to a society, you have to basically say, this is the rule, this is the, you know, the strong recommendation for everybody. I might finish there. I'm just going to quickly skip for the Prabhupada's purport again, just quickly to myself, and see if there's anything important that I've missed out. It's interesting how several times Prabhupada actually mentions that the population of women generally is more than the population of men. I don't know if that's still the case in modern society, but there's different reasons what they might be. Men are more likely to die, especially in former times, men are more likely to die in war. The Mahabharata War, the Battle of Kurukshetra, was the greatest example where millions died. But there were no women on the battlefield, actually. That was one of the rules, a very important rule, actually. Young men, or men of all ages, are more likely to take risks, are more likely to do things where their life is perhaps slightly more in danger, and so forth. Women live longer than men as well, actually. That's a modern fact. And so, on the whole, the female population is a few percent more, which doesn't sound huge, but it can, you know, when you, you know, 1% of 100 million people is quite a lot of people. But Prabhupada here is strongly saying that all women should be protected in a civilized, Krishna conscious, actually, society. That's very important. Right, I'll stop there. I've actually gone through quite a lot of things. We've done the principles, we've done sannyas, we've done renunciation, we've done all kinds of things, actually. Polygamy, we've even done. Mahabharata, we've touched on. So perhaps there's some comments or questions. Srinivas Prabhu. Oh, the mic. Yes, of course.
Two points. One is, you mentioned this thing about polygamy, right?
Polygamy, yeah.
Yeah. There was one Tamil peasant in ISKCON in Prabhupada's time, and Prabhupada wrote a letter that if he wants to have more than one wife, he should go outside and work. Within our movement, we cannot allow that because we are trying to overcome the bodily platform. The Prabhupada was very strong on the point of how we should see through the eyes of scriptures and practice the spiritual path to overcome the bodily platform. But there are people who cannot come to that platform, and for them to become steady, they may have to have more than one wife. King Yudhishthira was involved in gambling, you know, before the Battle of Kurukshetra happened. They were forced to gamble. But one thing he didn't gamble was the brahmanas. So this is why he won the kingdom back. So if you take shelter of brahmanas, you're always safe.
So even Yudhishthira, when it came to gambling, he gambled his brothers away, he gambled his armies away, he gambled his chariots and his weapons, and his own brothers, you know, Nakula, Sahadeva, Bhima and Arjuna, he gambled them all away to Dhritarashtra, but he didn't gamble any brahmanas away. In other words, even though Yudhishthira had this one vice, which, of course, which was gambling, his borderline didn't stretch to the brahmanas. That's quite interesting, actually. Because any civilized society, like I mentioned earlier, brahmanas and sannyasis, of course, protected and honored. Women, protected and honored. Cows, protected and honoured. Seniors, protected and honoured. Children, protected and honoured. Those are actually sociological foundations for a good society. Thank you. Anything else? There's a Mahatma at the back there who's going to be speaking, I believe.
It's interesting when you say to have more than one wife and to think, but there's also practical considerations like, can you support them? You know, if you haven't got the finance and being able to satisfy them in two ways, materially and spiritually, then and they could be squabbling that one prefers to be Krishna conscious and the other one's not. You know, there's so many aspects to it. You know, so it's like a recipe for disaster as well if we're not careful.
Because
if it's to satisfy the men's desires, then it's definitely a problem.
It's definitely not an ideal. Even Prabhupada here actually writes, you know, in terms of the quote I gave from the Adilila 458, Prabhupada's purport, it was actually a curse. It was presented as a curse. So it's definitely not the ideal. There was even, you know, envy between the wives of Dasrat, Kaikeyi, and so forth. So we can see what that led to in the Ramayana. We can see the problem. However, what Prabhupada is saying here is that it has to be there as if the alternative, or whenever the alternative is going to be basically unprotected women who are basically living as if they were prostitutes, to use a, you know, to use direct language, which Prabhupada himself uses. It's not, I think that language is quite strong, but from a Vedic point of view, that's what it would be. Anything else? Maybe this is the last question, I think, because it's nearly 8:30. Sorry, I didn't hear. Is that microphone working? Is it on? I didn't hear it.
Can you hear me?
That's better, yeah. It's also for the people online as well, so they can hear.
So you spoke about veganism, that it's increasing in general public as well as the ISKCON devotee community. So I can see point why people are becoming vegan, and even I'm inclined to become vegan. At the same time, I'm in favor of Ahimsa milk, because it makes sense, you know, if cows are properly protected, loved, cared, then Ahimsa milk is good. Is it some focus area in ISKCON to provide Ahimsa milk to the special devotee community easily as well as reasonable price?
Okay, first of all, there is a Ahimsa farm in Leicestershire which is run by Sitaram Prabhu, and you can actually go on the website Ahimsa Milk. They are trying, and of course our own cows, as much as possible, we do have, I mean, there is about, is it 60 cows? Well, actually that includes bulls as well, so it's less than 60 cows, something like 40 cows we have. And their milk is used to make Mangalasti sweets and so forth. But it's not enough for our huge congregation. So there is an Ahimsa milk that is provided. However, frankly, in comparison with the demand and the influence that Bhaktivedanta Manor has and its huge congregation, there's not enough Ahimsa milk to go around, or frankly. So therefore, obviously we would definitely recommend at least organic milk. If someone's getting supermarket milk, someone has to have milk, but they can't access or even afford Ahimsa milk, then I guess organic milk at the very least would be there. However, I speak to a lot of devotees. There are even a few sannyasis in ISKCON which are qualified vegans, which means they're vegan, but if they can access Ahimsa milk when they're travelling to a particular temple, then they would have that milk. So that's okay. In terms of, it's an individual choice, I would say, which I think vegetarian devotees should at least respect the decisions of vegan devotees, I think, given that, Vedically, of course, there's lots of references to milk products, the important cow, Krishna himself was a cowherd boy. So Vedically, milk is part of the culture, part of the diet, for definite. However, the treatment of cows in the modern dairy industry and how they are linked, and how the male calves, of course, are killed immediately because, of course, they don't give milk. So this is demoniac. It's completely demoniac. Again, referring to our purport here, Prabhupada said this is demoniac. So is there a divine aspect to the modern dairy industry? No. So I think we have to respect devotees and make that choice. But there are health reasons, cultural reasons as well, why it's difficult for everybody to do that right now. It's part of an ongoing process. I imagine that the conclusion, I think, on, as far as I understand on GBC level, is that we should be promoting our own farms as much as possible. You know, as much as possible, I guess. What can you say? But of course, the other argument is that there's also an argument is that if you're offering organic milk at home, you're offering it to Krishna, then the cow benefits from that offering, and that is the perhaps a balanced, realistic standard. But ideally, we shouldn't be having milk from cows that are getting slaughtered. Simple as that. Ideally, do we live in an ideal world? No. Ideally, we shouldn't be breathing in polluted car fumes. But do we? We're forced to, especially if we live in an urban area, or even if we don't. Do you see what I mean? And so we have this, we live in this world which is pretty much a Kali Yuga situation, which is not ideal. But we have to take shelter of the holy names, we have to, you know, basically do these things as the purificatory process, more than any, more as the greater thing, offering our food, offering our milk. But certainly having organic milk over, choosing that over inorganic milk would definitely be a recommendation within ISKCON. You meet devotees who are vegan, and, you know, you can chat with them and decide, just make your own decisions. But calcium, of course, calcium comes from milk, but it's very important for when bones are growing. If you have weak bones, or for children, they should have milk in their diet, actually. So it's a difficult one. It's a tricky one, and it's an ongoing external and internal dialogue, I think. Of course, I was met up. The reason why I mentioned veganism, a few months ago, some people came from the Vegan Society to preach to me. It's an interesting situation. Normally we preach to people, but they came to preach to us. But they were atheists, you see. You see what I'm trying to say? They didn't practice any kind of meditation. They didn't have a belief. They didn't believe in religion. They didn't have any faith in anything what we would call spiritual. But their one thing, their religion was their diet. So they were a vegan, but they were kind of almost on the verge of being blasphemous towards Krishna, actually. So compare that position with offering your organic milk at home, you know, praying, you know, please Krishna, you know, accept this milk for the cow's benefit as well as my own. We're Krishna conscious, not vegetarian in a sense, or vegan. We are vegetarian, but we're first and foremost following Krishna. If Krishna, and it's not, it doesn't happen, if Krishna said you can do X, Y, Z, we could do X, Y, Z. But he doesn't, so therefore we're vegetarian. You see what I mean? We're Krishnatarians. So the higher principle is to offer vegetarian food. Of course, no intoxicants, you know, no caffeine, or no onions and garlic or mushrooms as well. But these are the, this is the diet, if you like, that Prabhupada has given us, in a sense. And so, by and large, we have to stick to that. Is that helpful, or is that more confusing than? All right, I think we'll stop there, because otherwise we'll be here forever. So thank you very much indeed for listening. Antara Chaitanya Chaitanya Ki Jai. All glories to some devotees. Hare Krishna.